Okay. Well, I'll have Bonnie call the case and cause number and attorneys who will argue.
Court will now call TWI 18 Incorporated et al. Versus Carroll Family Investments et al. Bankley Court, Mr. William L. Wood will argue for the appellant. Mr. R. William Wood, Mr. Sam Burke will argue for the appellant.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Wolf, are you ready to begin?
Yes.
All right, come forward and go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Bill Wolf. I represent the appellants in essentially an interlocutory appeal of an injunction. I'd like to start by obviously stating the obvious, that injunctions are not by right. They're statutorily controlled. They're restricted. They're extraordinary relief. This case is essentially, I want to start with the point of the fourth point of error, whereby we contend that the relief granted in the temporary injunction is overly broad and vague, including requiring appellants to speculate regarding the prohibitions imposed by the injunction. Bless you. The order that was signed basically says that there are restrictions that probably amount, it's not clear because you have to make some assumptions about the language, says there's $12 million of funds that are restricted, essentially regarding a judgment that is for $800,000+. If you look at it, it essentially takes $1.5 million from five accounts for Kelly Hall, and it takes $1.5 million for three accounts for John Crowder. It is also involves the restriction that no assets can be disposed of unless clear documentation to a source other than an asset sale that is subject to this litigation. Well, money is fungible, and so even that part is completely unclear as to what that means.
Gone back to the trial court and asked for some clarification or complained to the trial court that it's vague or ambiguous or something?
We did. Well, we did at the time. We did it by letter when we submitted comments, but our comments weren't submitted, and the order was submitted, and she signed it before she looked at our comments. I'm going to get to a second where there is, in fact, a clarification by the appellees.
The big picture here is that CFI has a judgment against TWI and TWI 18, which has become final, correct?
Correct.
TWI and TWI 18 are, shall we say, insolvent.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Why not?
Well, because the best that I can tell from the record, the only obligation that hasn't been paid is the judgment they have.
If there's nothing there, that's not the question. The question is, there anything to pay them with in those two entities?
No, not at this moment that I know of.
Okay.
So what happened was is that there was, if you read the appellee's brief, there basically is, they say that we complain that it's not clear about the $1.5 million in each account, and they say the order is clear that the amount to be retained applies to each individual and is cumulative as to the account specifically mentioned in the order.
So are we talking about under the "it is further ordered" on the last page, paragraph one, or?
Yes.
Could you point to me exactly where
it's actually page two. It says is further ordered that Kelly Hall and his agents, servants, employees, and then it basically restricts five different accounts for Kelly Hall at $1.5 million apiece.
Are we on order granting temporary injunction?
Yes.
Okay, and I'm on page two.
Very bottom. It's further ordered that Kelly Hall and his agents.
Yes.
And then on to the next page.
Yes.
The first decretal portion there is Kelly Hall, and the second decretal portion is John Crowder. That's the part that is unclear. I think that it's probably more likely that it's $12 million, because, like I said, there's five accounts at $1.5 million, and there's three accounts at $1.5 million. So there'd be $12 million essentially held in a sequestration while there is a determination whether or not there is a fraudulent transfer. So in the appellee's brief, they claim categorically conclusory that the order is clear. But then last week, the appellees filed plaintiff's motion to modify and clarify temporary injunction as to restrain on John Crowder and Kelly Hall's accounts. So there is a new filing last week to essentially limit it to $1.5 million per individual. So instead of $12 million, it would be $3 million. $3 million for a judgment equal to about $860,000+. So that was filed last week, and we have requested that the record be supplemented, but we only did that yesterday, and they've already got it prepared. We just had to send the check. So that will be as part of the record. We didn't get it here because it only happened last week. So that's...
So what are you wanting? Are you wanting us to send it back to the trial court and say it's vague and ambiguous? Please clarify, in other words, what he's doing and what I would have thought you would have done. You would have gone back there and said, what do you mean by this? Or what are you asking us to do, void it because it's unclear? What?
Well, yeah, it's clearly void. I mean, they have decided
if it's clearly void.
Well, what I'm saying is, in my view, that there's no, it is, you cannot have an order that can't be interpreted. It's an injunction that we now have the appellee saying, we agree this needs to be clarified. I don't think you can get much more clear that it's unclear.
But you don't, this isn't like a normal situation where you have to go back to the trial court and point out the error or you waive it. If you think there's an error in this order, you have no responsibility to go back and ask for clarification or...
No, Your Honor.
You have no responsibility to do that.
No, in fact, but we did that. I mean, just so it's clear, we went to the court, we wrote the letter and said, this is completely unclear regarding 1.5 per account and all. That didn't get anywhere. So we've already, I mean, I didn't do it as a formal motion, but it essentially, I said that, and we said that basically to the court. So at this point, it's the case is the injunction, because it's extraordinary relief, must stand on its own. We don't have to, other than what we said. We tried to get it clarified before it was signed. So, Judge, the problem is that you have something that we now know for 4 months has restricted, allegedly, I don't think it does, but essentially that's way, 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 way more than anything that could possibly be necessary here. And so that's the first point. I think our point of error number 4 has essentially been ratified and confirmed by the request to amend it and change the terms of the injunction.
Does that make point?
Go ahead.
Excuse me. Does that make point 4? Moot?
No, because no, Judge.
My question, what if the court acts on it and says, yep, it is $1.5 million cumulatively, not separately?
I don't think it's moot, because I think at this point we don't have any modification by the trial court. The record we have is essentially a request to modify.
Well, if the trial court modifies it before we hand down an opinion, isn't it moot then?
No, because the request that's been made, if you look at the actual request, and it only came last week, it actually expands the definition of the accounts. If you look at the thing that they're asking for, they're now asking, instead of the assets held by Kelly Hall at those bank accounts, there's a new insertion, quote, in any account owned by Kelly Hall, co-owned by Kelly Hall, or in which Kelly Hall is a signatory. So now, while it reduces the amount, it broadens such that, for example, if any of these people are signatories to a nonprofit corporation or a trust, it would be enjoined because it would be a signatory. So, again, I don't think we can actually litigate until we know what would actually happen, but it's just showing you the problem with the language that is unclear and vague. And one way they're making it less, $1.5 million for each, but in the other way they're making the account, the definition of account, hugely more broad, which is also not pled, and the injunction has to follow what was pled, and that's not the relief they requested in their application. The next point I want to get to is the probable, imminent, and irreparable injury prong. And that's obviously a predicate. There has to be an actual threatened bless you, injury. And an injury is irreparable if the injured party cannot be adequately compensated in damages.
We've gone to point one, correct?
Correct.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, correct. That part of prong one, point one. The The amount, this is quintessentially just the payment of money. I mean, this is...
You have a finalized judgment for a little over $1 million, and the entities that are culpable under the judgment have nothing. So they're seeking to freeze something to see that it's there. All right?
I think that's exactly what they're doing.
Tell me why there's no probable injury if all the entities that are related to the insolvent entity are allowed to disperse the monies?
Well, Judge, the test is whether or not they have the money to respond to this judgment. The question is, if they get a judgment against John Crowder or Kelly Hall, the question is, and it cannot be, if it's just a payment of money, irreparable harm. It can't be that. That's what it says. The payment of money that's certain doesn't involve irreparable threatened harm. That's just the legal standard for an injunction. It doesn't mean that if there's not a judgment for $1 million that they pay it. But a couple of things. The record shows that counsels represented the court in an ex parte conference they had back when they got the TRO. They met for a time period to discuss this. In that conversation, he said that the clients had millions of dollars. Counsel testified, that they believed that they could respond in damages if, in fact, a judgment is rendered. And finally, the testimony of John Crowder at the hearing was he had $30 million of liquid assets. So there is no irreparable harm. It's not a theoretical harm. If they get a judgment, someone will pay it. They've got these.
Well, they have a judgment, and no one's paid it.
Well, but Judge, Justice, the issue is against the person who's not an entity, who has those assets, and can respond. In other words, the prong of...
But isn't the irreparable harm tied up in the fraudulent transfer? The irreparable harm is the fraud, right? That's what they've alleged?
Well,
I mean, if we went under your theory, in a fraudulent transfer, you would never be able to obtain an injunction because it's just money.
No, I think, for example, the case that they cite is that basically if the defendant that you're targeting is insolvent, doesn't have money, you could get an injunction because you would say, or if they couldn't respond to the damages, but the record
well,
is...
Well, why, what evidence did you put on, or what evidence is there? Because I noticed that the temporary injunction order says after conducting a lengthy evidentiary hearing. So what evidence was put on at the temporary injunction hearing concerning the solvency and the ability to pay the existing judgment?
Mr. Burke testified that he, in his ex parte meeting with the trial judge, said that they had millions.
Well, I'm talking about evidence introduced at the temporary injunction hearing. Okay, what evidence was introduced of solvency?
Mr. Crowder, on cross-examination by Mr. Burke, was asked, how much do you have in liquid assets today? And he said, around $30 million. That's in the record.
Okay, so there was just his testimony. There was no evidence of bank statements or assets or...
Oh, no, bank statements were introduced, too. It shows million. I mean, they've got million. I mean, he acknowledged in his testimony that they have millions of dollars. And so the bank records are in. Their acknowledgment by counsel is in.
The bank records of the entities.
No, that's Mr. Crowder, the only person we're trying to enjoin here. Mr. Crowder had said he had $30 million, and there's a bunch of bank records in the record that show that he has millions of dollars, such that if they get a judgment, bless you, for $800,000+, they can get just collected. And so you get into the cases say a fear or an apprehension or possibilities aren't sufficient to find the prong necessary that there is an imminent, probable, and irreparable injury. Now,
you said something, maybe I misheard it. You said if the defendant was insolvent and didn't have anything, then maybe you could get an injunction. And of course, what comes to my mind is, what would you enjoin if the defendant was insolvent?
Well, not so much just insolvent, but the fact that you couldn't respond. In other words, if you were down to where you had, $200,000 and your claim was $500,000, you might be able to, under the existing case law, that might satisfy the prong of irreparable harm. Because,
and if you have zero, there's nothing to enjoin because there's nothing there to enjoin.
Justice, I have to distinguish between the entities they have a judgment against and the parties they're suing and enjoining here. The individuals they're suing here got on the stand and was told, he said that, counsel said that they had the money, that had millions, acknowledged that they could pay the judgment, that if as and when it happened. And finally, he asked the question under oath, and he said he had $30 million of, there's no shortfall here. If
part
they get
of which
judge-
came from TWI or TWI 18?
Pardon me?
Part of which came from TWI or TWI 18?
Oh, no, no. And in fact, if I can move forward, because I think maybe if you haven't looked at, I don't know how much you've read, whatnot, but the amount of money that is contended to have been received by John Crowder, for example, there is a check for that and more within 2 weeks of when the distributions occurred. I don't know if you've looked at, there's a check from Little Big Wings such that John Crowder, it's undisputed, put more money back in after he got the money out. In other words, there was a distribution. He put it back in within 2 weeks.
But not into TWI or TWI 18.
No, exactly into TWI. He essentially put more money in than he got in the same entity.
Where is it now?
It was used for all kinds of things. It was used for Mastodon, a broker's commission. There was a CPA who was paid. There were litigation and lawyers were paid. There were fees that were spent by the entity. And that's not been raised as anything that was improper what was paid. What they're saying is that he got money, and it is undisputed that $857,000 was returned by John Crowder to TWI, such that after he made that payment, the deemed distribution to him was less. He put more money in. This is like a windfall transfer, not a fraudulent transfer.
Okay, I think your light went out.
Yes.
But it'll come back on.
Okay, did I go the whole time, or?
Yes, you did.
It'll come back on after.
Okay.
We'll grant the other side extra, 5 minutes?
Oh. Okay.
A couple of minutes. And then you have rebuttal time.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Who's Mr. Burke? Are you ready to present Appley's side?
Please, the court. Provided you with an outline, and of course don't have to follow along, but I think given what Mr. Wolf has said, I'd like to start around page 29. That's the legal standards that apply to injunctions in circumstances such as this, and I think it's important at the outset to establish that the purpose of the injunction was to prevent us from having to engage in a multiplicity of actions to collect this judgment. We have a judgment against TWI and TWI 18 Inc. That judgment is final. It's undisputed, I believe, that they transferred those funds from the asset sale, $56 million in total, around $5 million, just shy of that with regard to these two entities. Those monies were dispersed to the shareholders. John Crowder was one of those shareholders. Kelly Hall's wife was one of those shareholders.
That between 18 and 18, we'll call it, and I know 18 only got $16,000 or something, it $5 million more or less came in and was transferred out.
That's correct.
From the sale. Got it.
That's correct. And a legal remedy, and that's what we're seeking in this case, a money judgment against Crowder or Hall, among other things, will not be considered adequate unless it is as practical and efficient to ends of justice as an equitable remedy. In other words, we shouldn't have to file multiple actions to get a money judgment against multiple entities unless that's as efficient as the injunctive relief we seek. The injunctive relief we seek is to freeze in accounts where we know these people have money, $1.5 million, so we don't have to go chase it down anymore. That's all we want.
What about his starting out on point number four?
With regard to the amount that's frozen?
Yes.
What we intended by that language was to freeze $1.5 million cumulatively. To the extent that's unclear, I guess he's saying it's capable of more than one interpretation. We're going to fix that with the trial court. There's no reason to quibble about it.
I perceive that his position is the injunction is void if it's vague and ambiguous.
I don't think it's vague and ambiguous, and to the extent that it's capable of more than one interpretation. We're seeking the least restrictive interpretation, and we're going to fix it.
What about broadening the intent which is applicable, according to...
I disagree with him, but if that language has that effect, we'll look at our injunction carefully when we go back to the trial court and make sure we mirror that language. We're just not trying to do that. We want to freeze the accounts of these individuals in the amount that secures the judgment we're going to seek, which is a judgment against TWI and TWI 18 Inc., the fraudulent transfer of those funds, plus attorney's fees, plus what we believe to be reasonable anticipation of some punitive damages. So a plaintiff does not have an adequate remedy law if the defendant is going to be insolvent. And we've cited the cases in our brief where it has been shown in cases like this where people have multiple entities and they've demonstrated the ability to transfer assets between those entities quickly, that you can freeze those funds or that asset to keep it from being moved around. Because just because John Crowder has $30 million now does not mean he's going to have $30 million in an account in his name when we get the judgment. They've demonstrated a willingness and an ability in the past to transfer assets out of entities that we have a judgment against. There was a lease in this case in the underlying lawsuit. That lease provided that they were, if they sold all their assets, they were to get a substitute guarantor. John Crowder was the real estate specialist. He attended the mediation in the underlying lawsuit. Kelly Hall was the ultimate decision maker and CEO for TWI, which was actually the operating entity. Both of those gentlemen either knew or should have known about that promise. They didn't see that it was followed. The documentary evidence in this case demonstrates they retained that liability. In short order, they distributed all the funds out of the entities and did nothing to make sure that there was going to be funds sufficient to pay that judgment. In connection with that, in the middle of this asset sale, there's a communication from their counsel, John Gessner, to me, asking us for a settlement demand. Exhibit 18 is a spreadsheet we sent to him saying, look, you owe us $860,000. They not only knew, because it was a summary judgment on liability, they knew what we contended the debt was, and we were actually conservative by $9,000. And still they did nothing. With regard to the arguments, which I think are kind of new, and I think you've got to the heart of it, is there any question about insolvency here? I mean, to me, it's just as clear as it can be. I've given you the document, the portion of the record that I think is clear. With regard to reasonably equivalent value, I think it's 9 pages total you can read. You can read, I think it's 44 through 51 in Reporter's Record 2, and I think it's pages 61 and 62 in Reporter's Record 3, where John Crowder testifies about the timing of the transfer, okay? With regard to the argument that there was reasonably equivalent value given in return, John Crowder, if you believe him, says 2 weeks after this transfer out to him, at which point the entity is insolvent, the fraudulent transfer has occurred, you can't cure it, okay? He says he gave all that money back. Well, if you look at the evidence, he didn't give anything back. An entity gave money back, okay? It was Little Big Wings. And if you look at the memo sections on those checks, neither of those memo sections indicate that the payment was made for John Crowder. One of them was made for one of the Big Wings Holdings entities, which was kind of a rollover entity where they purchased part of the purchasing entity. The other one was for Louisville Wings. Their own documentary evidence indicates those payments weren't made for John Crowder. They were made for entities that he holds an interest in. And I think it's illustrative. I think John Crowder testified at this hearing, or Mr. Wolf indicated on the record, that Mr. Crowder uses Little Big Wings as his personal bank. That's like how he does his business. And that's the problem. These guys got between 40 and 80 entities, and at the back of this, there was an incorrect cite in the record with regard to the testimony about the 40 to 80 entities. I think it's in miscellaneous page 2. There's the correct cite, because we cited the wrong part of the record there. They absolutely testified. They got 40 to 80 entities. They can move this stuff around at will. And I think, you know, I've been doing this case since 2009 in one form or another. I think it's important that we get this relief so that my client can have confidence that the judgments of our courts mean something. That when you get a piece of paper that says you owe me $869,000, that ultimately that means if you have the money, you're going to pay the money. And it doesn't matter how many entities you own or control. It doesn't matter if you are going to move to Florida and play tennis in Croatia, sell in your house and move to Boston. You can't play around with your obligations. No matter how many entities you have or what your means are, our judgments mean something, and I think that's all we're trying to accomplish with our injunction. With regard to reasonably equivalent value, if you look at the definition, which I think is 24.004, in order to be reasonably equivalent value, it has to be value in the first instance. And the first part of being value is it has to be in exchange, okay? Paying money back after the fact is not a transfer in exchange. The testimony at the injunction hearing was that this was a distribution to shareholders. If you think about what that means, a distribution to a shareholder, by definition, in common sense, is a payment of money on account of your ownership of the shares. It's not ever going to be an exchange for property or the payment of an antecedent debt. So all of this, we did some work here, or I helped with the asset sale, or I guaranteed to the buyer some indemnity obligations. None of those are an exchange of property or for an antecedent debt. And if you look at the definition of value, it also says, basically, in my opinion, there's a but in the middle. If you make a promise to support the debtor, not in the ordinary course of business, and it's unperformed, okay, so basically an unperformed guarantee, to support the debtor, that's never, ever value. And I think that's one of the things they're submitting to you as value, this promise to the buyer that if indemnity obligations exceed a certain amount, that that is going to be the value we gave, or, you know, we're going to indemnify you over this amount. That's not an exchange. And if you look at the testimony, each of the shareholders received a sum of money commensurate with their percentages of ownership. And Mr. Kreider testified to that roughly on pages, I think, 61 or 62. Reporter's Record 3. In other words, we got a formula, we applied it to each of the entities, we looked at who owned what entity, and we distributed it. So if that's the case, there was no exchange for that distribution for labor, guarantee, or anything else. Okay? With regard to the affirmative defenses, I think that's actually kind of an interesting thing you might address. I don't think that in a temporary injunction setting, affirmative defenses can be raised. There's this subject to the provisions of 24.009 language. And then below that, you've got an injunctive remedies, you know, subject to equities and applicable rules of civil procedure. I think that there's some conflict there because the rules of equity don't allow you to consider affirmative defenses. And I think the way you harmonize those two sections is, well, you apply the defenses at the permanent injunction phase, you don't apply them at the temporary injunction phase because your rules of equity control in addition to those defenses. So that's how I would resolve that conflict, or suggest that you could. With regard to Mr. Hall and the transfers to Judy Hall, if you look at 3.104, at the outset, that's a provision that's intended to protect creditors, not spouses of creditors, okay? And what it does is it creates a presumption that in the event you have an asset that's held in someone's name, that it's sole management community property. We believe that we overcame that presumption by proof that Kelly Hall was the president of TWI, that he was the decision maker for TWI, and that he negotiated the sales price for TWI's assets. I think that overcomes the presumption of sole management community property. I think, a little more interestingly, it doesn't matter in a fraudulent transfer case. Under 24.009B, we can obtain a judgment against a person for whose benefit a transfer is made. The extent that this is community property, and I think that there's no evidence it was sole separate property, half of that transfer, whether or not it was sole management community property or otherwise, was for Mr. Hall's benefit because he has a half community interest in it. And you've got cases where you say you can't collect a contract cause of action or other types of cause of action against sole management community property. But I think in a fraudulent transfer case, if that transfer is made for the benefit of someone, that's exactly what it says, you can recover against them. And I think the sole management community distinction versus a joint management community distinction therefore does not matter in this instance. And I think that that's important to observe and look at that statutory language.
Can you, let's say in 30 seconds, walk us through this sale and connect TWI, Big Wing Holdings, all these people, HOA, what happened?
Okay.
Just in 30 seconds.
Okay, TWI. TWI and TWI 18 Inc. are among 40 or 50 entities. They own or operate the Hooters franchises for the state of Texas. Okay, HOA Holdings is owned or controlled by a group out of Georgia. They want to buy the Texas franchises. There's a there's an asset purchase agreement that's entered into whereby the TWI entities agree to sell all their assets to the HOA Holdings. HOA Holdings purchases those assets. And they pay $56 million. TWI acts as the seller's representative and takes all that money. It all gets commingled, and that's another important fact, and then distributes it out based on an EBITDA formula to all the different shareholders based on their percentage of ownership. And then as part of this sale, Mr. Crowder, Mr. Hall, and Mrs. Hall agreed that they were going to use some of the proceeds from the sale to buy an interest in HOA Holdings. In order to do that, or as part of doing that more properly, they created Big Wings Holdings and Big Wings Holdings 2. They directed Texas Wings Inc. to transfer their funds, I think it's $26 million total, through Big Wings Holdings and Big Wings Holdings 2, who then paid HOA Holdings for percentages of ownership in that entity. HOA Holdings then transferred, I think it was a membership interest in those entities to Big Wings Holdings and Big Wings Holdings 2. And that contract, the asset purchase agreement, requires that the owner, or actually the controlling person of those Big Wings Holdings and Big Wings Holdings 2 entities be Kelly Hall. Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions?
I believe not. Thank you very much
for
your argument.
Thank you for
your time. And now we have time for rebuttal.
A couple things. First of all, the testimony undisputed by John Crowder was that he paid back the money with Little Big Wings account. It doesn't matter if it was paid by whatever entity. That's the undisputed testimony. He put back in more than he took out. So the idea that it's a different entity, I can't imagine if the notion is creditors' rights and insolvency or how the money got back in, more money came back in from whatever source and it was directed and caused by John Crowder. That's the undisputed record.
You're telling us that John Crowder got less than $1 million out of this sale.
But no, but he's done a good job. Judge, there's, Justice, there are 45, 50 entities.
Right.
The only place they can chase is TWI and TWI 18.
Right.
He got more out because he owned other entities. But if you look at strictly what the tax returns, which are in the record, say he got a deemed distribution of 700 and some thousand, and within 2 weeks he returned it. It's not a fraudulent transfer. It's a windfall. He put money into the entity. And the thing is, there's a case that came out Thursday. I got it literally as I was going over here. The 14th District out of Houston basically does an analysis of reasonable equivalent value. It's called Bauman versus El Paso, and it's out of the 14th District. It literally came down Thursday, and it explains that it's not this one day, next day. It's the idea that you make an analysis to see whether the debtor lost anything. If more money, if I give him a dollar and he puts in a dollar and a quarter, how can that be a fraudulent transfer? It's benefited the enterprise. It happened within weeks. So there is no fraudulent transfer, and that the idea that he's not liable for the other debts. All he's liable for is what came in, and he put back in more, and that's undisputed. The other thing that you have to remember when he talks about Judy Hall is Judy Hall was the largest shareholder. She's deceased. She's not a defendant. Kelly Hall, it's undisputed, owns no shares in these entities. He never received a distribution. He's not a shareholder. He essentially had a wife who died. All this was going on while she had pancreatic cancer, and she didn't pay a lot of attention. But at the end of the day, the person who got a bunch of money is Judy Hall, and she's not a defendant here. Kelly Hall is not responsible for those distributions. It is special community presumed to be. They are. You don't conflate the two. So when you hear this stuff about, oh, Judy Hall, and she signed, she's not a defendant in this case. I don't know why, but she's not. So the idea that you got one party who didn't get any distributions because he's not a shareholder, that's not disputed, and the other that they're chasing put more money in than he took out. I had a trustee in bankruptcy I talked to the other week, and he said, boy, I wish all my cases were someone were putting in more money than they got out. So this idea of reasonable equivalent value is that this is not a situation where money went out and it deprived the enterprise of paying whatever debts. In fact, what Mr. Crowder testified at the hearing, at the temporary injunction hearing, was almost all of the, he believed that all of the appellants put their money back in. The money went out. It was done on some kind of autopilot. And when they found out that they had all these other bills and expenses, they put their money back in. In Mr. Crowder's case, he put more than what he got out back in to pay for expenses and costs and attorney's fees and all kinds of things that no one had counted on. That's not a fraudulent transfer. That's people being responsible putting their money back in. At the end of the day, their debt was challenged at the Court of Appeals and up to the Supreme Court because it was not believed to be an actual debt. So at the end of the day, it was a disputed obligation that went along. But I believe the record shows that there is no debt other than that that remains unpaid that I'm aware of, other than some litigation that's still ongoing with claims and things. So at the end of the day, we have two defendants who are being that can respond to damages. They have acknowledged by counsel that they have plenty of money to pay. So if there is a judgment, there is a fraudulent transfer, we don't need this injunction, whether or not it's clear or not. And at the end of the day, the two parties that they're focused on, and this man wasn't clear from his discussion because he kept talking about Judy Hall. She's not defended. She got a bunch of money, and she's not here. Kelly Hall, it's undisputed, doesn't own any shares. He can't be a transferee under this fraudulent transfer statute. You can't be a transferee if you're not an owner. You're not a distributor. And yet, when you conflate, he got money because there's 50 entities of which he did have some ownership, so some money got to him. But TWI's creditors can't essentially glob on to monies that flowed to other entities.
You're telling us again that I believe TW18 got something like $16,000, and TWI together, the two of them, didn't get but $700,000 or $800,000 out of this sale.
No, that's not, because that's what's confusing. When he says $4 million, he's not explaining that most of that money went to Judy Hall, who's not a defendant. None of it went to Kelly Hall because he's not a shareholder, and the money that's undisputed that was deemed distribution to John Crowder was paid back and more.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your excellent arguments, and we appreciate your appearing here today. Your case is submitted, and you're excused. We thank you.